from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on this morning's Forum program, if you struggle with getting healthy meals on the table for your kids after a long day at work, you're not alone. Dietitian Jill West talked to 400 nutritionists to ask what they feed their own kids. And it turns out that even for nutrition experts, dinner sometimes means choosing the healthiest drive-thru option. We'll talk with West and two pediatricians about how to help kids develop healthy eating habits, what food battles are worth fighting, and how to keep our kids eating well without having to become a full-time organic gardener and chef. And that's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. First Lady Michelle Obama's campaign to reduce childhood obesity has brought attention not only to the importance of eating healthy to stay healthy for children, but to the fact that children who are overweight are more likely to be bullied and to slow down physically. Moreover, children eating a healthy and balanced diet, research shows, means greater attention span, also means better academic performance, among many other things. And in this Forum Hour, we want to focus on what foods children ought to be eating for the best and healthiest effects. Joining us in studio is Jill West. She's a registered dietitian and author of a book called 400 Moms, Discover What 400 Nutrition Experts Feed Their Kids. Welcome, Jill West.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Dr. Amy Beck in here with studio with us, pediatrician and co-director of Healthy Lifestyles Clinic at UCSF's Benioff Children's Hospital. She's a pediatrician, and San Francisco General Hospital has a Healthy Lifestyles Clinic. She does research on the effects of beverages on children's health. Welcome, Amy Beck.
Thank you.
Dr. June Tester, also here with us in studio, also a pediatrician, co-directs Healthy Hearts Program at Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland, and we welcome you to the program as well.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here, and I'm going to begin with Jill West. It's an ambitious project to talk to no less than 400 dietitians and nutrition experts, and as her book says, for less than the cost of a pizza, you can change your child's life in terms of those 15 to 20,000 meals that are given to your children until adulthood. Better to cook at home and not to necessarily obviously go out for fast food, but go out to restaurants that often. Have as many family meals as you can, really.
Absolutely. And family meals certainly can include any meal of the day. But I think the one that parents struggle with the most is dinner time. And I certainly can attest to that as well. I have three boys, and at 5:30, they're teenagers now, and they still ask, Mom, what's for dinner? So it's a real challenge, and a lot of great ways to get quick and healthy meals on the table without having to be fast food.
Well, as far as dinner, pasta continues to be, at least again, in that number one choice where nutritionists are concerned, yeah?
Yes. When I surveyed the 400 moms, pasta was their number one choice, and that sometimes surprises people. I think pasta gets a bad rap, but there are certainly whole grain pastas, and as part of a healthy plate, if there's pasta with meat sauce on half the plate and a fruit and vegetable with a glass of milk, it's a really great meal that's well balanced and quick.
Well, I'm looking at your book here, and you've got a healthy plate for dinner. 50%, that is half, ought to be fruits and vegetables, 25% grain, 25% low fat protein. A lot of emphasis, in fact, here on fruits and vegetables and how fruits and vegetables can become more of a staple, because they have to be if you want a healthy kid.
Absolutely. And I think that's very tough to do in a fast food meal, getting half your plate fruits and vegetables. So you can still provide something that's a quick dinner. Even something like chicken nuggets that are baked is going to be healthier than the fried version. And then most importantly, getting those carrots and some washed strawberries and a glass of milk, and you've got it there in 20 minutes.
Well, let me shift from dinner for a moment to breakfast, because last night, I went to a lecture that Alice Waters gave. It was part of the Galanter UCSF annual lecture honoring Maurice Galanter by the Department of Surgery. And she was going into her rap about against fast food and for the slow food movement and so forth. But she held up some Cheerios and she said, you know, Cheerios has more cornstarch and more sugar in it. And yet these nutritionists are saying for breakfast, and I want to talk about breakfast with all of you, most important meal of the day, and yet about 37%, according to Jill's book, of young people, children, don't even have breakfast. And I got to tell you, I never had breakfast as a kid. I'm sorry. This is like confessional time, but it's true. But I would say never, but almost never. But anyway, Cheerios? What do you have to say about Cheerios?
Yeah, so the 400 nutrition experts, the number one breakfast they feed their kids is cereal, and the number one cereal was Cheerios. Now, you have to be careful about which Cheerios. They run the spectrum. There are the low-sugar with fiber Cheerios, and there are the high-sugar ones, which I try to outline in my book with some of the best picks and worst picks for cereals and all kinds of foods. So Cheerios is a great option because you can combine that with milk and some fruit, and you've gotten three food groups in a pretty quick breakfast meal before heading out the door.
I also like what you say about fruits and vegetables and their importance being more important than concern over pesticides being in organic food. And I'd like to go to pediatricians on this. I mean, all this emphasis on organic food, Amy Beck and June Tester, I don't know which of you want to come in here and so forth. I mean, first of all, it is more expensive, but the idea that it's more healthy is also really up for controversy. And we've had this controversy. I've gone over it many times on this program. Yeah.
The topic certainly comes up a lot, and it's actually sometimes really hard to see parents who are especially really struggling with making ends meet in the first place, making choices and saying, gosh, you know, doctor, I am shopping at Whole Foods, I'm going places where there's more organic food, but realizing that they can't actually buy as much in terms of quantity in terms of fresh vegetables and fruits. And that's really hard to see parents really trying hard and feeling like they're doing the best for their children, but actually having it in some ways backfire.
Amy Beck.
Yeah. So I think actually the data that we have shows that as far as nutritional value goes, there is no difference that's been determined between organic food and non-organic food. There is the concern about pesticides, of course, but I think that, you know, washing fruits and vegetables really well before you consume them takes off a lot of the pesticide residue. So I don't actually advise my patients to purchase organic foods. If parents want to purchase organic foods, then I certainly would never discourage that. And there's potentially some benefit in terms of the pesticide burden, but I think it's much, much more important for kids to be eating several servings of fruits and vegetables every day and just washing those really well. For certain fruits and vegetables, if you're concerned, you could always peel them as well.
What's the best way to wash fruits and vegetables? I mean, a little bit of soap, or what do you use?
Just copious amounts of water.
Copious water, okay. Yeah. And then you mentioned we keep coming back to fruits and vegetables, and Jill West in her book talks about, you know, putting fruit on cereal to make it more a part of breakfast and everything. But how important is breakfast? I mean, there are a lot of good tips like that in the book. But get back to that essential question. I heard it almost like a drumbeat throughout my childhood, and I know most of the listeners have breakfast the most important meal of the day. Like I said, I was not a breakfast guy. I'm fairly robust and healthy in spite of that.
So there is some research which shows that if you eat a breakfast, and particularly breakfast that contains some protein, so thinking about your milk that, you know, from the cereal or an egg, that you'll actually have a slightly decreased appetite later and would be less likely to overeat at later times in the day. And there's also research that shows that children do better academically when they've had breakfast, probably because even if they're not hungry first thing in the morning, they might get hungry long before the school lunch is served or the time for lunch. So I think both for the academic benefits and for potentially reducing overeating later, you know, it's really advisable.
And what does your research show about the best beverages, for example, as far as juices in the morning or throughout, for that matter, the course of the day?
So I think that the research in general shows that the best beverages for children to be drinking are water and unflavored milk, so not your chocolate milk, not your strawberry milk.
And what about whole milk, skim milk versus, low-fat milk and all those kinds of things? Can you help us out here, June Tester?
Sure. You know, there are so many benefits for making sure that kids are drinking low-fat dairy. And, you know, I think that doesn't mean that all fats are necessarily bad. And I think, you know, one important concept is the idea of just upgrading your fats rather than just blindly saying you limit all sources of fat in your diet. 1% dairy is what we recommend to our children, and anyone over the age of 2 doesn't really need whole milk.
And let's talk about fat, because there's new study, new research that shows a big article in the New York Times just a couple of days ago that unsaturated fat, contrary to long-held opinions, does not necessarily lead to cardiac arrest or any kind of coronary thrombosis or anything along those. In fact, it doesn't really even do much harm where the heart is concerned, if any. So this is kind of changing and shifting the territory here, isn't it?
Yeah, I personally think it's very interesting, and that was one very well done article. There have been several other large, what are called meta-analyses, which look at data from, you know, numerous studies, and they have found that, contrary to what people expected, that consuming saturated fat does not seem to elevate your risk of, you know, heart attack, stroke, some of those bad outcomes that we want to prevent. And so, you know, personally, I don't feel strongly about kids switching from whole milk to skim milk at any point, and I don't think that we have good evidence to suggest that that's actually protective for them. I think what's more important is that they take in some source of milk, because we think that there are a lot of benefits from the calcium in milk, the protein, and the vitamin D. But I think we may have missed the boat quite significantly in terms of this very strong focus on saturated fat. And the research really hasn't borne out the connection directly between consuming saturated fat and, you know, any particular bad outcomes.
Well, Jill West, we talked with you about breakfast and dinner. Let's talk a little bit about lunch, because one thing I did as a boy, in addition to not eating breakfast, I had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches almost every day. And again, the nutrition value. I mean, a lot of people think peanut butter is not good for you, but quite the contrary. In fact, it's good fat in peanut butter, and you get some protein too. And most of these dietitians and nutritionists give their kids peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for lunch. Yeah?
That's right. And I wanted to follow up Amy's comment on the milk, because lunchtime is a time when many kids aren't getting milk anymore. And I think our most important message, whether it's the whole milk and the saturated fat or a low-fat milk, is most importantly for parents to be getting their kids to drink milk. What we've seen since the 1970s is that kids are consuming about half as much milk as they used to, and what's replacing it is a lot of sweet drinks. So most importantly, getting parents to serve milk and water. And since it's not being served at lunch, then trying to get milk and dairy in the afternoon as well.
You point out kind of my mother used to force milk on me. If I hadn't got to the point where I was drinking it regularly, because I didn't like it that much, you point out, like, with picky eaters, if you give a kid green beans, you just keep doing it. You don't try to get heavy. You just keep repeating it. And maybe you can even change the taste buds.
Exactly. I call that try again. And as kids' taste buds change and as they mature, if we don't keep going back to trying again, then we never give them the opportunity to learn that they actually like them. So that try again, whether it's milk, vegetables, any kind of foods that kids are picky about, is important. And in terms of the lunch, and the peanut butter sandwich, that is one that's the number one choice for nutrition experts. And when one of my boys was in second grade, he literally took half a peanut butter sandwich and dried mango every day. And parents would say, "You're okay with that?" And I said, "Yes, because one, I know he's getting refueled. I know he's actually eating his lunch. And two, I can bring in variety at all the other meals and other snacks." And so if he was happy with that, I was happy with that.
You're really sneaky with the fruits and vegetables. I gotta give you a lot of credit on that score. I mean, because it gets them down their gullet. In her book, she talks about, and I want to hear the pediatrician's response to this. There's a lot of "did you know" and enlightenment. And she says, "Did you know most popular granola bars are only slightly better than Kellogg's Pop-Tarts?" Nobody would say a Pop-Tart is a healthy choice, but many parents believe snack bars are healthy. The truth is most snack bars are just like cookies, low in fiber, high in sugar, unless you're choosing the best pick snack bars that she gives in her book. But so, again, you know, these things are out there, like the myths of snack bars being healthy. Yeah?
We have, so our nutritionist in our clinic actually made a handout specifically about decoding granola bars, because it is a really confusing topic. Especially when we come back to that concept of parents who are trying really hard and well-meaning, it's tricky territory.
It's also tricky territory just deciding about refined carbs and really paying attention to what the ingredients are on just about everything. One of your colleagues, Amy Beck, who's made a name for himself as Bob Lustig, who is pretty much of the mind that sugar is, I suppose, like demon rum or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe toxic. Even has some relationship to cancer and so forth. What do you say about desserts, you guys? To Amy or Dr.
So
Beck, Dr. Tester?
I think that I encourage parents to see desserts as a treat, and to not something that needs to be consumed daily. And if your family has a habit of having dessert every day, to try to make that dessert something like fruit and some yogurt, or to try to pick a dessert that's lower in sugar and has higher nutritional value, and save the sort of desserts that are very high in sugar for an occasional treat rather than everyday consumption.
Of course, the thing that parents face, and let's just hear what each of you maybe has to opine on this, nowadays is getting a meal together very quickly and under often telling circumstances and pressures and so forth. And so it does compel many to think of, if not fast foods, if they eschew fast foods, just getting something together really fast. And some tips, some thoughts.
Well, I would start with one thing I would definitely say is parents really want to do this right, and they are trying very hard. And so having those quick and easy strategies is really important. And one of the things I suggest is making sure you have quick options in the freezer. And some of the recipes in the 400 Moms book are designed for that as well. Things like pizza bagels, pizza quesadilla. Again, that's half that plate. And then if you have shopped and planned for vegetables, again, the carrots, steamed broccoli, cut up an apple and a glass of milk. It's very quick. So having those, doing some planning and having those quick options in the freezer, I think is really critical.
You also talk about best picks like box mac and cheese in terms of fast food and so forth.
Exactly. I am not opposed, and people oftentimes think, you know, dietitians must not serve their kids chicken tenders or mac and cheese. The reality is kids love those foods. And in the mix of what you're serving, and most importantly, getting those fruits and vegetables along with it, is far healthier than the chicken nuggets, french fries, and soda that they would be getting on the road.
I like to just kind of advocate
Please,
for the concept
Dr.
of
June
actually
Tester.
Not letting fast food own the word convenience, right? Because you can make your own home-cooked food, partially prepared the day before, what have you, you know, go-tos in your fridge. You can have your own convenience food.
Can we also talk a bit about yogurt? I mean, you mentioned, well, fruit and yogurt together, for example, Jill West, and give some thoughts about that. But a lot of yogurt has a ton of sugar in it. Again, we're back to Bob Lustig.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about yogurt? I mean, are flavored yogurts a healthy choice?
So I have a lot of concerns about yogurt, because when you start reading the labels, there are flavored yogurts. There are certain brands of strawberry yogurt that have as much sugar as 8 ounces of Coca-Cola. So I strongly encourage my patients to purchase plain yogurt, so unflavored, and then to add fruit as a sweetener. So cut up apple, cut up banana, frozen blueberries, whatever works for them. Even if you put a little bit of sugar or honey on yogurt yourself, you would end up with much, much, much less sugar than you get in the prepackaged. So it's an area in our Healthy Lifestyles Clinic at San Francisco General where we do a lot of nutrition education, and we actually show parents how to read the food labels, and people are shocked. And I was shocked myself. I didn't always read the labels on my yogurt. But when I started, I realized you know, that yogurt could be a major contributor in terms of added sugar in the diet.
And June Tester, what do you tell your patients about sodium? I'm sure you get asked a lot.
Sure, especially because, you know, our clinic, Healthy Hearts, is a pediatric weight management clinic, so a lot of our kids have high blood pressure. You know, I think in a way, actually, nothing too exotic, because actually, if you follow a lot of the basic guidelines about actually having whole foods rather than pre-prepared convenience foods, you know, avoiding eating out, actually, a lot of it actually follows through. Actually, the thing I wanted to say about yogurt is I actually have 2 children. I have a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old, and it's pretty amazing how brightly packaged and appealing yogurt is in the supermarket in tubes and small tubs and very cute packages. And so it's tough. I mean, it's tough to push that shopping cart by the yogurt aisle and not have your children pining.
It's also tough when your kids see all this these children's food advertised on television, especially if they're up for cartoon shows and, you know, all those kinds of things that people don't want to eat because they have so much crap in them. I'm going to give out the phone number. I'm going to invite those of you listening to join in. I know there are many of you who are really keenly interested in getting more information about what to feed your kids or what kids should be eating to be healthy, or you may want to weigh in here, in fact, because there are lots of opinions out there too. But this is an opportunity for you certainly to have questions answered. Jill West with us, a registered dietitian and author of 400 Moms, Discover What 400 Nutrition Experts Feed Their Kids. Dr. Amy Beck, a pediatrician at UCSF's Benioff Children's Hospital and co-director of Healthy Lifestyles Clinic at the San Francisco General Hospital, and Dr. June Tester, who is a pediatrician and co-director director of the Healthy Hearts Program at Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland, and you can be a part of the program. Let me tell you the phone number to call if you have questions or comments. It's toll-free, and you can join us now at 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number available to you, 866-733-6786. And if you struggle with getting healthy meals on the table for your kids after a long day of work, you're certainly not alone. It turns out that even for nutrition experts, dinner sometimes means choosing the healthiest drive-through option. So we're talking about some of those options and talking about what's best and what's healthiest for kids and what food battles are worth fighting and maybe how to keep kids eating well and without you having to become a full-time organic gardener or a chef. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and you can post any questions or comments you might have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Obviously, a number of ways to get in touch with us. And can we talk a little bit, since it's Alice Waters' lecture last night is still in my head, and you know, she was talking about Eric Schlosser and fast food and how bad it is in fast food nation, and everything is geared toward making us a fast food nation, and we have to get back into the slow food movement. And where do you all weigh in on that?
Well, I'd be
Jill
happy
West,
to start.
Jill West, yeah, go sure. ahead. You got a big smile on your face.
Well, it's not music to most parents' ears, I'm afraid. It's a real challenge to balance the slow food when our lives are not slow. And so I think finding that balance between getting as many whole foods, and I agree with the organic is not the priority. There's far more harm in not getting the fruits and vegetables at all than the risk of the pesticides. So most importantly, getting those fruits and vegetables. And the more of those whole foods we can get, I agree, that's fabulous, but I think there really is a balance, and we want parents to be able to be successful, and if we set the bar at slow foods and spending lots of time in the kitchen, I think we're going to do far more harm than we are going to help.
I'm often torn about the topic because I have how I feel about it professionally and then how I feel about it personally. I mean, my husband and I, we've been to we vacationed once and we went to the slow food conference in Italy and, of course, had a wonderful time. And, you know, I love to cook and embrace a lot of the values. But then there's the reality of what you actually recommend to people and actually recommend that's going to be sustainable and really good advice for them. And so I don't talk to patients about the slow food movement.
You all kind of come down in a moderate way in terms of this, as opposed to one end of the continuum or the other. That's what I'm hearing, at least. Maybe a synthesis or a realization of that. What do you do about picky eaters?
We all have at least one, don't we? Yes. And, you know, one thing I'd like to follow up on the slow food versus the faster lifestyle is one way to help balance that is sometimes weekends are a time where you can do more of that cooking and preparation time. And I'm blessed with a husband who likes to cook. And so I maximize what he cooks and use it throughout the week. So it's allowing you to use more of those whole foods, but it doesn't mean every day that has to happen. So I just wanted to throw that idea out there as well.
And by the way, there is a Best Picks yogurt section in your book. Do you want to talk about that just quickly since we were dwelling on yogurt?
Sure. I agree with Dr. Beck that plain yogurt and adding in your little bit of sugar, vanilla, cinnamon, fruit is the ideal option. However, another perspective is if your child is having that instead of cookies or chips, even if it's the yogurt with sugar in it, they're at least getting valuable nutrients, calcium, potassium, vitamin D. So it all depends on how this is fitting in. And if it gets them to combine that with a fruit and get a couple of food groups in that afternoon snack, I'm not entirely opposed.
Jill West's book, again, is 400 Moms, Discover What 400 Nutrition Experts Feed Their Kids. She's here with us in studio. So is Dr. Amy Beck, a pediatrician at UCSF, and Dr. June Tester, who is a pediatrician at Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland. And we will go right to your calls when we return here. Again, you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about what to feed the kids, your children or children in general. And Dr. June Tester's here from Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland, and Dr. Amy Beck, who is also a pediatrician at the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital and co-directs Healthy Lifestyles Clinic at SF General, and Jill West, a registered dietitian and author of 400 Moms, subtitle, Discover What 400 Nutrition Experts Feed Their Kids. And let's go right to your calls. And we begin, Gail, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a really picky son. He's actually on the spectrum. And I worry all the time because he only eats broccoli and plain yogurts and any meat. Should I panic that it's the same vegetable every day or just be grateful he's eating that one vegetable?
Now, wasn't it former President Bush the elder who said, I don't like broccoli and wouldn't eat broccoli? It's nice, I guess, to hear a kid's liking only broccoli. But that whole idea of kind of mono diets and just eating those, should she be concerned, Amy Beck?
No, I don't think so. I think broccoli in particular, it has fiber, it has vitamin C. It's truly a superfood. So I think that if a child likes broccoli and will actually eat it every day, you're covering a lot of nutritional bases. I have seen patients who have gotten down to 3 or 4 individual foods that they will eat for quite a long periods of time. And every once in a while, it's made me a little nervous and I've checked some nutritional labs. And assuming that those choices were pretty reasonable, I've actually found that those kids have done well. They've grown well. Their nutritional labs have been normal. So I think that parents have a lot of anxiety about pickiness. And sometimes that anxiety ends up kind of affecting the child and may actually make them more picky. So I think that taking a more relaxed approach, obviously encouraging the child to try new things at any opportunity, praising them if they do try new things, but not getting overly concerned if they remain picky. I like the idea people talk about parents provide, children decide. And so this concept that parents decide what to offer their child, where and when the child decides if they want to eat or not. But within that, I think that some parents know my child is not going to eat XYZ. They will eat that. So pick something of the things that you offer that you know your child will eat.
What do we know in the way of research about children having different taste buds? I've always believed they do. I've had some serious arguments about this, though, with people. What do we know? June Tester?
You mean whether individual people between themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me just logical.
People certainly have different preferences. And actually, like Gail mentioned, some people actually have more preferences that are geared based also because of the texture in their foods as well, not just flavor and taste families. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen the research, but I don't know. It seems to be true.
Well, let's get some of Jill's thoughts about, because I know this is in your book, about tips for getting kids to eat more vegetables.
Absolutely. The 400 moms provided lots and lots of ideas and strategies. There are 2 pages worth of 37 ideas to get kids to eat vegetables. And coming back to Gail, the caller, I would say her child's eating broccoli. That's wonderful. And I would periodically try again with those other vegetables and just put a couple of green beans there next to it because you never know when her child might decide to try some of the others. The other ideas I really like, one of my favorites is to give them choices. So to ask them, would you like broccoli or carrots with your dinner? And if they say neither, then I say, okay, I'll choose. And you do that enough times and kids start to realize, I'd rather have the choice than having my mom choose. So that's sometimes a strategy that can work as well.
Actually, there's a tip in your book along those lines for breakfast to decide the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And that, becomes a collaborative effort. And
it takes the stress off of that morning rush that breakfast is already decided.
Let's bring some more callers on. Michelle, good morning.
Hi. I'm a mom to a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old and have the sort of classic, busy, working full-time, got to get dinner on the table quick. And this is something that I care about, and I want to feed my kids healthy meals. And I might listen to a show like this and be motivated and try for a while, but then my motivation wanes and I kind of start to forget. So what I was wondering...
Excuse me, Michelle. Psychologists call that a leap to health.
Yes, right. Exactly. I've worked on it for myself. I lost about 90 pounds. I'm in my second year of maintenance. So I have a lot of experience with this for myself. And one of the things I found was that I needed help being reminded that this was important. And I needed cues. I call them healthy cues in my everyday life to remind me why this matters to me and why it's important that I put effort into it. I'm wondering if there's something like that around the food that I feed my kids. If you guys have a Facebook page where you're posting things periodically, do you have a newsletter that you're sending out like weekly saying, hey, this is why this is important and, here are some meal tips or ideas. Or do you have anything like that that you're putting out there?
Jo West nodding your head. Yeah.
Yes. First, I want to say what a great role model you are to your 5 and 3 year old. So thank you for that. And secondly, yes, if you go to 400moms.com, there's a place where you can sign up for a newsletter. And I also have a Facebook fan page, facebook.com/400moms. So that may help with both of those.
And good luck to you, Michelle. Thank you for your call. And we'll go next to Jennifer in the city. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. My question, or rather, I was wondering what kind of research is out there on ethnic foods. You know, I'm someone, as the U.S. is becoming increasingly diverse, I grew up with a very low milk diet, and I've found that I've turned out okay, and I'm actually kind of increasingly more healthy than some of my white American peers. So I wanted to see what kind of research is out there on other cultures who do not use milk in their diet.
Well, I guess so many different kinds of ethnic food, though. I don't know. Can any of you shed any light on this? And
do you mean research specifically about the dairy question, or just more about variation in diet?
Dairy specifically, but other foods as well.
Well, I've always been struck, for example, by the fact that Japanese women have such low incidence of breast cancer. I mean, it must have something to do with the diet by comparison to American women. I mean, in other words, maybe if people talk about Mediterranean diet being the healthiest kind of diet and unhealthy diets, like the one I grew up with, Ashkenazi. But you understand what I think she's asking here. What do we know?
I think it's interesting. I think, for example, with the whole question of carbohydrates, you know, there are examples of societies where people eat tremendous amount of saturated fat, very low carbohydrate diet, and they have very low rates of heart disease. There are other examples of societies where they eat very high carbohydrate diet, significantly higher than the typical Western diet. Granted, these are not refined carbohydrates. These are complex. And they also have very low rates of heart disease. So my take from all of this is that humans are omnivorous, meaning we can probably eat many different whole foods and have healthy outcomes. And then there's probably some individual variation. There are people who don't tolerate milk for whatever reason, and there are people who don't tolerate certain foods well. So I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer in the sense that there is one society or one diet that is ideal. I think that there are probably strengths and weaknesses, and I think that the American Western diet has more weaknesses than strengths currently.
And the Mediterranean diet, more strengths and weaknesses.
Absolutely. The Mediterranean diet, more strengths and weaknesses. Absolutely.
Let me bring another caller on. And Charles, that's you. Good morning. You're on.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My son has a dairy and egg allergy. So he gets a lot of soy milk, and he loves soy nut butter and jelly sandwiches for lunch. And I'm just wondering if, you know, there's too much soy in his diet, if that has a problem with, you know, estrogen and that kind of thing.
Are you concerned, or have other people voiced a concern to you?
Well, I've just heard it mentioned here and there, and I know he gets a lot of soy, so I just wondered if there was a danger.
You know, I think the thing, I hear... I think, you know, what we said earlier as well is that variety is always key. And as well, you know, so, I mean, it sounds like you found some great options and some other great options for your son's diet. And I think just, you know, continuing to, you know, focus in on variety. I mean, whether it's too much soy,
should there be concern about the amount of soy, though, generally?
My take on that would be that if the child is getting soy milk just like we would serve cow's milk, so about 3 servings a day, that certainly isn't going to be a problem. I think where we get into the concentrated soy issue is when it's soy protein powders and the soy protein isolates. That's when the number of grams of soy goes up enough that I'd be concerned. But if it's in naturally occurring tofu, soy milk, I, as a nutritionist, wouldn't be concerned about that.
All right, let me thank the caller, and we'll bring on another caller from Emeryville. Linda, that's you. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you for the program. I appreciate a lot of what your guests have said, but there were a couple of things that were said early on that concerned me I wanted to see if we could address. I work with SES Global Services. We're a third-party certifier, and one thing that we do, and have focused on for 30 years, is certification of pesticide residue-free foods. And the reason is because pesticides in foods are a concern, and certainly a concern of many of the people in the audience. And it's not fair to say that washing your fruits is going to get rid of pesticides. That statement is very misleading because the pesticides that are applied during the production of food are absorbed into the flesh of the fruit or the vegetable. They don't just reside on the surface. Pesticides that your guests are referring to are the fungicides that are applied at a post-harvest level to the outside of the fruit to maintain its shelf life. And that is true, but it doesn't mean that if you wash the outside of your fruit or vegetable, you're going to eliminate all of the pesticide residue in the food. And so for people who are concerned about pesticide residue, as we should be, because we have organophosphate pesticides that are known neurotoxins that can, in fact, reside in the bodies of our children and ourselves, and we do need to be concerned about this. These are very potent chemicals, even at low levels. We have endocrine disruptors, we have carcinogens, we have reproductive toxins in pesticides, and any effort that a parent wants to make to eliminate, reduce levels of pesticides in their food should be encouraged, not simply by washing the outside of the
fruit. Well, Linda, you're getting actually some head nodding here from Dr. Amy Beck. You in agreement?
No, so absolutely. I completely agree that I'm aware that pesticides are absorbed into foods and into certain foods more than others. But I think that nonetheless, right now, the price differential between organic and non-organic for most people and at most times of year and in most sort of standard markets where people are purchasing does make consumption of all organic food cost prohibitive for families. And I would not want parents to avoid fruits and vegetables in order to avoid pesticides if they're not able to afford the organic foods. Certainly for people who have the choice, I think that's very reasonable choice to make. And I think that there are lists. Environmental Working Group has nice lists of foods that are higher in pesticides, foods that are lower in pesticides, if you wanted to select some foods to purchase organic and others not. But I still think that the nutritional benefits of consuming fruits and vegetables
outweighs
yeah. Yes,
yeah,
to
June
our
Tester
current knowledge.
Wanted to add something here.
Just along those lines as well, guideline that I like that's practical is the concept of the Dirty Dozen, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And so, I mean, that's something that, you know, listeners can look for. I can't list them all right now. But
yes. So following up on that, if they want to look to see what are the Dirty Dozen, which refers to those fruits and vegetables that are most important to buy organic, it's at the website ewg.org, which is the Environmental Working Group. The other thing I would add to that is buying local as often as you can. That is a great strategy that sometimes is a little more affordable than the organic in a grocery store. So when that opportunity is available, of course we encourage that. But the harm in not getting fruits and vegetables is far greater than emphasizing all organic.
What's your acronym, BEST Diet? What does that stand for again?
Yeah, so BEST, the B stands for breakfast every day. E is parents encouraging 5 servings of fruits and vegetables daily. S is to stop sweet drinks and soda. And T is to trim down on fast food and, if necessary, portions. And I use that as if that's what parents go away with, they're doing a fabulous job helping their kids become healthy adults.
Well, since we're speaking about soda and soft drinks again, Bella asks on our website, she says, I get the move away from soda and toward water, but why milk and dairy? What if you don't want to use animal products?
Well, what we've seen since 1970 is a decline in milk consumption by about 50% and more than a quadrupling of soda, which doesn't include sweet drinks. So what's happening there is kids are not getting the calcium, vitamin D, or potassium their bones need as they're growing. And so if it's not cow's milk, there needs to be, in my opinion, a source of a good source of calcium. So whether that's soy milk, almond milk, rice milk, as long as it's fortified with the calcium and vitamin D, we want to ensure our kids' bones are getting the calcium and vitamin D they need for proper growth.
We've got a bunch of questions here. Let me go to some of them before I go to more calls. Adriana says, what is a good food choice for the required after sports snack? We're not necessarily talking about Gatorade, I don't think, are we?
We would definitely not be talking about a sports drink. It's an excellent question. And depending on the age of the child, most importantly is getting a healthy whole food. So whether that's something like fruit and string cheese, I like to encourage two food groups. And if they're an athlete, we really want it to be a combination of carbohydrate and protein. It helps their muscles recover more quickly. So milk and crackers can work, especially if their whole grain crackers, yogurt and fruit, string cheese, and a piece of toast. Something that combines carbohydrate and protein is ideal.
Well, getting a lot of useful information and responses from listeners that are kind of observational. Let me just read a couple. Eileen writes, I had a lot of luck calling frozen peas popsicle peas. I served them right out of the freezer, and my kids ate them up for years. I also put a lot of zucchini and carrots in homemade muffins that were very nutritious.
We did the same in our house. They were always called freezy peas.
And James writes, last time Michael Pollan was on this show, he said something that I found extremely liberating, that frozen vegetables are nearly as healthy as fresh vegetables. Since then, the amount of vegetables we eat has increased dramatically from near zero to a few servings each day. My daughter actually likes the vegetables and asks for them regularly. And a listener asks, are cheesecakes healthy and is one type healthier than another? Cheese sticks, excuse me. Healthy and is one type healthier than another? Example, mozzarella versus Swiss. That's a serious question.
Yeah, I can say the cheesecake is not healthy. We'll just clarify that one. Cheese sticks are great, and whether it's Swiss, Jack, cheddar, or mozzarella, they're all great choices. They're a great protein source that's easy and on the go. So combining that with another food group is, in my opinion, an ideal combination.
Sure, and I just the only other thing I'll add is a cheese stick is a great after-school snack. Five cheese sticks, not such a great snack.
And we're getting flooded with questions about gluten, so where do you guys stand on gluten? Let's go right at it here. Amy Beck?
Yeah, so as a pediatrician, I think that my concern with gluten really applies to my patients who have celiac disease. For them, eliminating gluten is truly a life-saving intervention. I've also become convinced that some people have a sort of lower level of gluten intolerance, so they don't actually have celiac disease. If you did a biopsy, they wouldn't be positive. Their blood test wouldn't be positive. But they seem to feel better in eliminating gluten. And so I think it's a very reasonable thing to trial for people. But I also don't think that it is universally unhealthy. And I don't think that if you're child is doing well and not having any complaints at all, that there's any benefit to going on a gluten-free diet.
But there are allergies to gluten, and besides celiac disease, and there callers are asking about ADD links to gluten and things of that sort. Again, we need a lot more research on those fronts, don't we?
Yeah, it's not clear in terms of there's some research which shows that certain food dyes might exacerbate behaviors in kids with ADHD. But again, this is a very scant amount of data overall, and I'm not an expert in ADHD, but from my reading of the literature as a general pediatrician, I don't feel right now that there's any particular nutritional intervention that I would strongly recommend for all patients with ADHD.
I want to get to more calls, but let me just read a few more comments off the web. Christine writes, I'm glad to hear the speaker discuss the concept of try again. When my children were young, we had a no-thank-you serving. One bite of anything served was required each time it was presented, but if they did not want it after that, they could say no thank you.
I talk about that, too, the one-bite rule. Just try it. You don't create a lot of drama. They try it, and if they say black, you say, thanks so much for trying it.
And here's Steve who writes, I can vouch for the fact that having protein at breakfast gives you better energy throughout the day. Eggs are fine, but I prefer almond butter or peanut butter. Peanut butter should work great for kids. Bess says, French Kids Eat Everything by Karen LeBellon is an excellent example of how children will eat what parents provide. Interesting to me is how my vegan, vegetarian friends, either for ethical, personal choices, reasons, or religious reasons, just do not have the food issues most families have. And these are two working parents' families. Eric writes, I agree with your guest that organic food does not equate better nutritional content, but there is more than to organic than that. Better labor practices. Farm labor is not exposed to the same level of harmful chemicals. Often a different approach to farming in general. The absence of GMOs, and in my opinion, organic tastes better, which could help in getting kids to eat healthier. Dana writes, no, humans do not need to consume milk from any animal for any type of health benefits. Almond milk contains twice the calcium of cow's milk. Your guests need to know there are healthier alternatives than dairy milk. Aside from the current cruelty surrounding the production of dairy milk, many people, children included, are actually allergic to it, very upset with the message your guests are conveying. Almond milk, more nutritional? We'll get that on the record. Do we know?
I'd say different nutrition. It has calcium. It's fortified with calcium and vitamin D. It's pretty low in protein, so I wouldn't substitute it. I wouldn't equate it to milk in terms of the protein content. And it was certainly a reasonable alternative as well.
All right, we'll go to more calls. And Sheila, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. My son-in-law and daughter live in Berkeley, and they have two children, aged 6 and 4. And I am here 2 days a week, and I witness what they eat. And they are involved in a thing called Supper Club. On Sunday, they cook one enormous healthy meal. And then three other women and their husbands cook one enormous healthy meal. And they divide it up, and then they each get a total of 4 meals for the week. Everybody works. You know, everybody's a good mother. Everybody loves their children. And at least 4 nights a week, if not more, all of these 4 families and their kids are eating healthy meals. And each mother has only cooked 1 day for it. And they call it Supper Club. And I think it's fabulous. And my grandchildren eat beautiful, healthy meals. And my daughter has the rule that's the 3-bite rule, not the 1-bite rule. And the rule that she has is you can't sit down to the table and say, this is disgusting. You have to be civilized. And they're healthy and they eat good food. And I love the concept of Supper Club. And I just wanted to get it out there. And for the record, my son-in-law calls me a Krasny junkie.
I hope that won't do what junk food will do to you. And thank you for sharing that about the Supper Club. That's really lovely to hear.
Can we join?
Good idea. Yeah, they want to join. Everybody wants to join up here.
Takes a village to raise healthy kids.
And there's more than one way to do it.
There's another Berkeley caller. Jimmy, join us. Hi.
Yeah, so I'm glad that somebody brought up the issues of pesticides and glyphosate and endocrine disruptors. I mean, that's a very huge concern. But one of the things that I have a real issue with is the issue of blood acidity and the fact that really, like, cow's milk is pretty much calcium neutral when you actually ingest it because it severely raises the blood acidity, and the most readily available thing in the body to combat blood acidity is the calcium in your bones and in your marrow. And what it does is it leads to, you know, bone degeneration and osteoporosis, you know, heart problems, all types of these different things. And you know, using that as your main source of protein, it seems like a very counterproductive thing to do. I personally experienced horrific health issues from being pushed too much milk when I was a kid. And I think that it's, you know, and also, you know, ignorance of genetically modified foods in pretty much all of the conversation seems to be a troubling thing. I mean, they have studies that have shown that there are rats within the third generation of eating genetically modified products go completely sterile by the third generation. And nobody's talking about this. We're just eating it like it's okay, and it's being banned all over the world.
Jimmy, we've done a number of debates, obviously, on GMOs, and probably we'll have more. I'd like to see that research, by the way, because that's completely new to me about going on to the third generation. But any of you want to comment on Jimmy's call here? Jill West?
The one part I would comment on is I guess I wasn't advocating that milk is the primary protein source. It does provide some protein, but certainly getting protein from a variety of sources, both animal and vegetable or just vegetarian, certainly is an option for kids as well. So I wasn't really advocating that it was the primary protein source.
Let me read some web comments. Darcy writes, with regards to differences in children's tastes and preferences, children have more taste buds, including on the roof of the mouth, so they're more sensitive to tastes and flavors. With regards to picky eaters, one approach for introducing more vegetables and fruits can be centered around participation and preparation. For example, snapping green beans and arranging veggies as funny faces on a plate can be fun. as a way to introduce new foods to children by sight, sound, and feeling.
I will add to that just personally and professionally. So yes, in our house there is a lot of wash your hands and come and, you know, squeeze and make this salad with us together. Also for our clinic program, we found that one thing that really helps families that are going through our weight management program is actually enrolling kids in cooking classes, actually, where they are learning how to cook a healthy dish, you know, and not in their home. And I've actually seen kids in clinic afterwards where someone, you know, a child said to me, "No, I don't eat zucchini." And I looked at her and I said, "You know, last Saturday at that cooking class, remember we made ratatouille that had zucchini in it?" And she didn't realize.
Can you weigh in here for us, maybe, Amy Beck, on orange juice? Stephen from San Rafael says he's heard that because of its sugar content, it's almost as bad as soda. What he's done, he wants us to know, is diluted a small amount of juice with sparkling water. Delicious and undiluted juice now tastes much too sweet to me. Actually, I think Bob Lustig was talking about dangers of orange juice on this program at one time.
Yeah, I think the concern with orange juice is that essentially you're taking the sugar from the fruit without the fiber. And so the result is that you end up consuming a lot more sugar than you would if you ate the whole fruit. And you also don't have the fiber, which slows down the absorption of the sugar into your bloodstream. So I strongly recommend that parents serve water and fruit rather than orange juice.
Well, with seconds left here, Jill West, you want to weigh in on honey? We had a couple listeners who want to know about honey. Listener Salom, for example, says, "As a mother of a 4-year-old girl and a 2-year-old boy, I'm super excited to hear your guests making it sound easy. My question is about raw flax meal. My children love to take a spoonful of flax meal occasionally. Is it harmful? I'd also like to hear your opinion on honey."
So flax meal is wonderful. Lots of great phytochemicals and nutrients in that. So if they like it, continue allowing them to have it. In terms of honey, I really equate honey to sugar. To me, there's really very little difference.
Okay, I think that's going to wrap it up. Thank you all for your expertise here. And by the way, you can continue this conversation on our website by going to kqed.org/forum. And again, Jill West, you want to give out your website?
Yes, 400moms.com.
The book is called 400 Moms, Discover What 400 Nutrition Experts Feed Their Kids. Jill West is a registered dietitian author. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks, Dr. Amy Beck, pediatrician at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital and co-director of Healthy Lifestyles Clinic at SF General Hospital.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Dr. June Tester, pediatrician and co-director of the Healthy Hearts Program at Children's Hospital and Research Center in Oakland.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Jack Detch, Marisa Endicott, Mariam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Daniel Radin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.